It's time to focus on what drives e-commerce results. It's time for Browse Basket Buy.
Hi, everybody, and welcome to Browse Basket Buy, the podcast slash webinar that doesn't know what music AI listens to, but knows it will probably have algorithm. I don't know who wrote that. I think it was me. We'll do something about that. Joining me today, I'm very excited. A known quantity to me, an old colleague, is Parry Malm. Hello, Parry.
Hey, Dan. What's going on?
Not very much. But what I'm going to get to do, so normally what I get people to do, rather than me mangle your introduction and get it all wrong, if you could just tell us a little bit about your background and where you've been up until this point.
Well, it was a stormy day in 2006 when I paddled across the English Channel and wound up in the UK to claim asylum. And since then, it's been nowhere but uphill. I spent my career doing B2B marketing, doing all the boring stuff like sending out emails and doing webinars with former colleagues, all that sort of stuff that you don't want to do, but you just got to get done. So I wound up doing that for a few jobs. And then in 2015, I noticed there's a problem in the market that I had experienced. And this was that there's no technology in the market to optimize something very, very important, something very near and dear to my heart, email subject lines. So I started a company called Frazee, and Frazee generated and optimized email subject lines in 2015. So you got to remember, this is before ChatGPT. It's before anyone could even spell AI. We were there. And if you got emails from Sainsbury's or Tesco's or Curry's or brands like that, then you experienced Frazee's technology. I took that to, 10 or 11 million in revenue, about 100 employees in 2022. And then I sold it to a private equity consortium for, about $100 million, which is pretty cool. I didn't get all the money, unfortunately. My investors got a bunch of it, which kind of sucks. Then I retired. And I retired for 2 years. I stuck on for a year to help with the transitions, the new owners. Then I left and spent 2 years kind of just doing a bunch of stuff, going on walks. And I ate a lot of kimchi because kimchi is delicious.
Kimchi is good.
Yeah. And then in September of this year, I launched a new company called Drumbeat. This is drumbeat.com. And what it does is it's a AI program, AI SaaS that does all of the boring, unsexy B2B marketing tactics that actually work. So traditionally, people would have to either do it themselves or hire an agency or hire a marketer. The future of the world is moving towards AI systems that can do end-to-end planning, creation and orchestration of marketing. So that's what we're doing.
Awesome. Fantastic. And just to be clear, you paddled across from Canada. Am I correct?
It was a long way to go. I had very sore arms at the end of that paddle.
I can imagine it would be. And so yes, today we're talking about, rather unsurprisingly, given your background, we're going to talk about AI. So yes, as you mentioned, you started Frazee way before Gen AI became this massive thing that everyone's been talking about all the time. And before every vendor slapped AI powered or with it, including AI or whatever on their homepage. So what was the specific problem? You mentioned it started with some of the subject lines, but what was the specific problem that made you think machines could probably do this better than humans and actually where AI could help?
Yeah, so, I've always believed that you focus on the problem, right? There is a quote from Einstein that's often misquoted, and I'm going to paraphrase it, but it's like he said, if you understand a problem very, very well, then the solution is nothing but a matter of technical implementation. So what I basically realized is in a previous job, I had been sending out millions upon millions of emails. And I'd spend like a long time trying to figure out what subject lines worked. And sometimes one would work and another one wouldn't. I always tried to build a system, just a simple system, like a internal sort of like heuristic system to understand why some language worked and why some didn't. And there's just no way of doing it. So then I joined a company called Adestra, which is where Dan and I, you and I met back in the day. And I started dealing with thousands of marketers around the world. So I ran the customer success book, and everybody would go like, hey, what should I put in my subject line? I'm like, I don't really know. So then like at one point, the light bulb kind of went off and I'm like, this is a sort of ubiquitous problem that people have. There's no good models out there, either sort of like heuristic models or mathematical models, on what your subject line should be. And yet there's this like this inherent belief that it's a super important part of an email marketing campaign. So I went deep into the problem and basically worked out that this is a market opportunity. And there are a few ways of solving it. You know, one way would to be an agency, but I didn't want to do that. I didn't like the business model and the prospects of doing it. Another one would be to like be a sort of like swipe your credit card tool. But the thing is, like, language is so unique. It with the state of the art technology in 2015, you couldn't really do that. So instead, it was basically we would build generative language models on a brand to brand basis that would then output human sounding subject lines, run a whole bunch of tests, and based upon that test data, create optimized models to predict the outcome of language before it was sent out. And once we took that to market, everybody thought we were kind of crazy, because like they would say, like, well, first of all, like, there's not a business in that, you know, nobody cares about subject lines. And I was like, well, I think you're wrong. And then it was like, oh, it's never going to work, you know, machines can't write better than humans. And remember, this was in 2015. And I said, well, I think you're wrong. And then it was like, I mean, like, you know, there's just a litany of reasons why people would say it was never going to work, but I didn't listen to them because I thought it would work. And lo and behold, you know, 1 year led to another year, led to another year. And before long, we were a pretty big business with a respected brand, and made a lot of people a lot of money.
Yeah. And I mean, it absolutely is a big problem. I started off as an email marketer, and yeah, thinking about subject lines, and because they obviously trigger the most likely thing to trigger whether an email gets opened or not in the first place is absolutely something I spent a lot of time thinking about. What I'm interested in is obviously that it's a very language based thing. So it's very much about like what is the right language to include in a subject line, and whether a human being who receives it will find that interesting enough or relevant enough, or whatever, to open it. Was there a particular reason you think that something that drew you to language over, you know, you could have optimized something that's more sort of data-based, like the structure of the email, the positioning, something more technical. Was there something in particular that drew you to the language element of it and the words?
Well, sort of. I mean, I thought it was an interesting problem because, you know, I've always enjoyed languages. But really, you know, people think that language is not a data-based thing, but it ultimately is. It's just there's so much data involved with it and so much nuance, and because it's a human created thing, we don't often think of it as a source of data. But if you think about it, you know, if you use specific words, those words are going to be tied to a specific response that it triggers in the human brain. And when you have enough of these words, enough of these phrases being done at a grand scale, what you can then effectively do is create a model that models human behavior. You can predict how people respond to certain phrases and certain words at a grand scale. So it's actually a more interesting problem and a more ubiquitous problem than saying, what time should I send out this email? Which I always felt send time optimization was a load of malarkey. People built it because they could, not because it actually worked, right? Yeah. And there are companies doing that because it was a simple problem. Like there's already, you know, all the ESPs did it, all the different companies were already doing that. So it's kind of like there is no, what's the phrase that the MBA idiots use? There's no blue ocean, right?
Yeah.
But also like, I mean, it was one of those things that nobody else was doing. Yeah. I mean, so yeah, you got to skate to where the puck is going, not to where it is.
Yeah. And solve the, I always think it's useful to think, solve the harder problems, because those are the problems usually worth solving. Rather, as you say, the easy ones, the ones in easy reach are generally like, they're probably going to be lower value than the problems that are a bit further away and a bit more complex.
Well, yeah. I mean, we turned the business into, you know, we had multiple six-figure deals, and we even had a seven-figure deal on a multi-year. Like, it was a big problem that produced incredible results for customers.
Let's get into some obviously we've got an audience of e-commerce people, e-commerce marketers. So let's cut through some of the hype. What do you obviously see a lot of the AI stuff that's going on? Obviously, Gen AI has appeared everywhere. What do you think are some of the things that AI can legitimately do for an online retailer right now? Some things that can actually help them impact revenue. I mean, obviously, you could probably talk about email subject lines and email copy and all that kind of stuff. But what other kind of examples do you think there are?
Yeah, look, I mean, there's. Anything I say now is going to be wrong, because by the time people watch this, there'll be a new use case and whatnot. I think, you know, the main difference that we have with generative AI, though, is different from what most people think. Most people look at it and they think, okay, it's going to be to create content. And it, of course, it can create content. I mean, often the content is slop and is not very good. There's sort of two different things happening right now. You know, first of all, for the history of mankind, our biggest cognitive burden has been to create stuff. You know, the feeling where you're looking at like Microsoft Word, and you've got that sort of, you know, the blinking cursor, and you're like, how do I start writing this? You know, you don't know where to start. It's that blank page problem. Well, that problem is gone. That problem no longer exists. You can use ChatGPT or like whatever model to get going and give you a boilerplate. So the part of the human brain that's focused on creation, and we spent so many years focusing on that in our education systems, in our workplaces, is kind of no longer the important part of the brain. The important part is the part of the brain that curates, that actually that has this innate sense of goodness versus badness, this sort of a sense of style. And that is the part of the brain that's really important now. Being able to read something and do all the fact check stuff, fine, that goes without saying. But also going, just because it's written doesn't mean it's good. So then going, is it good? And why is it good? And that is actually very, very difficult. So that's sort of like area number one, where you can use it to create content, but you can't yet use it to create objectively good content. And this is a real challenge that people face, where now you can create lots of content. You've got this race to the bottom of shitty content being across the entire internet. So that's point number one. But then point number two, and this is where I'm not seeing it used enough right now, is marketing technology in general is basically workflow layers over, or it's sort of like layers of technology that automate workflows. And the problem with automations is that there's always a lot of places for those workflows to fall over, because automations were always based upon a sort of happy path. This is how things should go. But when it came upon edge cases or, you know, these things it didn't expect, they fell over. Whereas now with large language models, when you hit edge cases, when you hit points of ambiguity, you can actually interpret that with very little background information and very few instructions, and then send people in the right direction. Now, this is very good when it works. And then it works most of the time. When it doesn't work, it's very bad. But what it means is you can actually have these intricate workflows that used to be human driven, and you can extricate humans from that whole process. This is what I'm doing with this new business Drumbeat, where the whole sort of marketing planning and marketing strategy was always thought to be the domain of all these sort of like ivory tower marketing experts. But it turns out it's not. You know, and the ability to extract information from a non-marketer and turn that into a marketing framework that you can then create and orchestrate across all these different marketing channels is hugely powerful.
Yeah. So if we turn to a relevant e-commerce example, so something like, you know, a lot of tools allow you to create custom and build various kind of customer journeys, customer flows, all this kind of thing. And as you say, they're very linear processes, step, and follow this step. But you could have, if Gen AI was a bit involved in that process, you could actually make that far more customized, far more adaptive, far more reflective of what the experience of the customer is, rather than having something quite so fixed in binary. Is that fair to say?
Yeah, you certainly can. Whether you should is a different question. I mean, I'm a long time skeptic of personalization, which is not a popular thing to say these days. Everybody wants to personalize everything. But I've always thought personalization is kind of like, so do you remember in, what was it, the late 90s or early 2000s, and there is that Budweiser ad, the "What's up?" where all these football bros were calling each other up. "What's up?"
And we're showing our age slightly, Parry, but yeah.
We are. But it was a phenomenon, right? Where everybody was doing it. Like every like teen and 20 something in North America, maybe in the UK, they were phoning their buddies up and being like, "What's up?" Like it was just a thing. It was ubiquitous.
Yeah.
And that was not personalized, you know. So the challenge now is, you know, with the fragmentation of media, the fragmentation of attention spans, we lack these cultural zeitgeists. Mm-hmm. And if everything is personalized and you don't have a shared experience, but if you think about the products that go big, right, and the brands that go big, there's a level of shared experience, not personalization. You might have some level of mass customization, but like the best example these days, you know, is Taylor Swift, right? Mm-hmm. Where, I mean, whether or not you're a fan of Taylor Swift and her music, right? She was a juggernaut, this ubiquitous juggernaut that everybody was into for that one summer. What was it, like last summer, or the one before last?
Yeah.
Right? And so like you've got this sort of ubiquity of it, and she made a huge amount of money and she didn't personalize a damn thing. Mm. So while you like, just because you can personalize stuff doesn't mean you should. There are certain things that you should personalize. And I think the sort of like bottom of the funnel, like push comes to shove, bias or don't kind of stuff, you can personalize there very, very effectively. But I've always felt that top of funnel advertising level stuff is the things that should be generic.
Yeah.
Because there's power in that.
Yeah. Okay. Interesting. And is there a place for Gen AI in that? Is there a way of, as you say, if you've got like a lot of sort of, if you have got a lot of sort of technical flows and things going on at a lower level, is there a way to use Gen AI to help feed into a higher level, kind of make sure that we're sticking with a particular cultural view so that it does have a wider impact? Is that something people could look
at? Well, yeah. And this is actually one of the big challenges that people have with generative AI right now is they'll use ChatGPT natively with their own login. Mm. And five people in the company will use it and get five different outputs. And one of the big problems with ChatGPT, like if you picture the dumbest person you've ever met, just take a moment and think about the dumbest person you've ever met. I'm not going to name names, but mine is one of my co-founders. And okay.
We were thinking about the same person anyway. Yeah.
But right now, ChatGPT is telling the dumbest person you've met that they're super smart. Hmm. Right. And they're confirming their dumb ideas. Right. So what you need to make generative AI useful is you need a central version of the truth. Hmm. Right. So you need to be clear on what your messaging framework is, for example, if you're generating content. And this is where a lot of people fall over. They'll go, ChatGPT, write me a post about X. And they'll write you a post about X. And at first glance, you'll read it and be like, oh, this is great because it sounds coherent. It feels magical. But does it adhere to your value props? Is it actually driving your message home? Mm. Is it getting into the strategic angles that make your customers tick? And the answer is probably not.
Mm. So you need to manage and control that. And another interesting example, I guess, just going back to e-commerce is, you know, we talk about a lot about search and discovery, and there's a lot of talk about, like, I was at an event and talking to one particular brand who have a particular kind of view on things, and they don't like the idea of algorithms ever recommending anything. It's always about a sort of personal curated experience. And we talk about, you know, product recommendations and that level of personalization that is in those. So could AI feed into that? Is there a way of using AI to more sort of vary that kind of curated versus algorithm driven experience? Can it feed into that in some way as well?
Yeah. So I've just realized two things. Sorry, while you were talking there, your skin looks so much nicer than mine. You have much better lighting. I've got nothing but daylight here and then my top lights. And I've also just realized that it's really messy here. I haven't done a podcast in like 2 years. So I was like retired till last month. So I apologize to the viewers who think that I'm homeless or I'm just moving. This room has been like this since I moved into the house like 3 years ago.
It's a lovely room and there's nothing wrong with your skin. It's a beautiful thing.
Yeah. It's a beautiful shade of beige. I appreciate that. Thank you. I'm just a very beige person these days. Yeah. But look, so I think one of the challenges with AI personalization, and look, AI personalization is nothing new. Like this has been, we've been exposed to it for what, 10 or 15 years. It's been ubiquitous across every website. Like every Shopify app has off the shelf personalization using the same like next best action or next best product algorithms. There's nothing new about it. And one challenge I've got, you know, the example that I used to always use is booking.com. I remember I went to a friend's wedding in Milan one time.
Yeah.
So I booked a hotel in Milan, and still to this day, I get messages from booking.com about hotels in Milan, right? So you kind of go, you know, the way I think about it is like, you know, when you go to the supermarket, right? And you've got a little mental map of what you're going to do. I always start in the meat aisle. And then I get the meat, right? And then I go down past the sausages. I got little kids. They like sausages. Oh. And then I do the root veg and I come back up the salad aisle. And then I go over to the dairy. And I've got this whole mental map, you know. So like I've made a personalized journey there, right? Which is just kind of like it works for me. Yeah. I shop at Sainsbury's. The oldest thing in my wallet is my Nectar card. I get like personalized offers from Nectar, which is cool, right? And that's actually very handy, right?
Lot of offers for meat, I'm imagining, but yeah.
But then when I get to the checkout, they have those impulse buys, right? And the impulse buys aren't personalized, but you look at them and go like, oh, I do need a magazine showing me what happened to Kirk from Coronation Street. I mean, it could be all he's had a tough life, our Kirk he has. I always thought Fizz was good for him. But anyways, that's not the point, right? So what a lot of e-commerce sites miss is this generalized impulse purchase, this thing where it's like this sense of surprise and delight. You know, my big concern about the world in general is that we are losing our sense of surprise and delight. Think about the last time you went on holiday. Let's say you're going to Paris, right? Before you go, you look up the Eiffel Tower on Instagram and see pictures of it, right? And you read about it on Wikipedia, and then you go and you look at it and you're like, yeah, it looks like it did on Instagram. You don't get those moments of surprise and delight. I think e-commerce has been a real, real culprit of this also. You know, when you go to a shop and you see something that you haven't seen before and you're like, that's super cool. I'd like to try that on, right? Like, that's awesome. You don't get that online because what you see is the algorithmically determined next best items, which I think kind of sucks. And I think it creates a bad shopping experience. It also creates a bad commercial experience for retailers as well.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, I call it, I always like the word serendipity, which kind of explains that. Like, that's what it's very hard to replicate that in an e-commerce environment rather than, you know, that's the kind of thing where you might stumble across something and go, yeah, this is a lovely thing I was unaware of and I might add to my life. But that's quite hard to do.
Well, it's not as hard as people think, right? No. So like it's not done. It's not done because everything is supposed to be personalized. And the reason why we think that is because tech companies has rammed this down our throats for the last 15 years. And why have they done that? Because they can sell you personalization technology. They don't make money when you're selling the same thing to every person. But if you think about a buyer, right? Yeah. Let's say it's don't know. It's like Halloween. So, and you're Sainsbury's. So at checkout, you go, hey, maybe you need some Halloween candy. Add these five things. Instead of going, oh, you buy a lot of pepperoni sticks. You didn't add any this week. Do you want the same thing you did last week? Yeah. Right. Which is good too, but you got to mix surprise with the necessary. And that's where I just think a lot of these e-commerce systems are missing the trick. Yeah. And it's because the tech companies do not make money from it. That's not a product they can sell you.
Absolutely. Absolutely. Yeah, absolutely. We are the worst. Not just us, all of them. Yeah, so let's talk about the data needed for AI, because this is a question we get a lot from people. Is like, well, do I have enough data for AI? So what kind of data would an e-commerce business, if they were like, right, let's try doing some AI, is there a minimum amount of data they need? Is there some data that's more useful than others? What kind of things do people need if they really want to start their sort of journey with AI?
Well, it goes back to this terrible paraphrase that I made of Einstein, and I'm going to paraphrase it again in a slightly different way. If you've got an hour to solve a problem, spend 55 minutes thinking about the problem, and then in 5 minutes, you'll figure out what the solution is. Okay. You don't need to do AI unless it's the best way to solve your problem. So like, you know, and as far as like data for AI, with large language models, you don't need data. Right. I mean, what large language models are is they've already collected all of the data, and then you just need to focus on ensuring you're asking it the right questions, and the questions you ask it are therefore your data going in. They call it prompt engineering, which, by the way, is the dumbest phrase that I've ever heard in my life.
Yeah, I'm not a fan of that. Yeah,
it's well, and there are all sorts of prompt engineers being hired 3 years ago, and now they're all unemployed because people realize that they're useless. But anyways, if you're doing something that's like heavier lifting, like next best product, things like that, then you need a bunch of data. And there's no rules about how much data you do or don't need. And there's various statistical ways to like increase data sets. It's called synthetic data. So like it depends what the problem is, right? But my general thesis is like you shouldn't use AI the vast majority of problems do not need AI. You do not need to drive a Ferrari to the corner store. Mm-hmm. You can if you want, yeah, but it's a lot cheaper to take a Ford Focus.
Yeah, yeah. Okay. If people are being, I guess the question then is, if people are being pressured into it, if there's a lot of, and I think this is where a lot of the AI growth has come from, is a lot more of it is the pressure from above to kind of say, well, I've heard about AI, or, you know, you go to your investors, your board, your management, whatever, and they will say, well, I've heard about AI, it can definitely make us more efficient. So everyone go away and try and experiment with it and figure out how it can make you more efficient. Would your argument be, don't start that way? Instead, as you say, focus on the problem first and then figure out if AI might be the answer, but it might not be.
Yeah, look, I mean, my big thing, the thing that I always did at Frazee is like, focus on the problem. If you've got an internal problem, then deal with the problem. You know, we signed up, like, once the company got really big, I really stopped enjoying running it, to be honest, because I wasn't involved in solving problems. And people would come to me with these problems and they go, oh, here's a solution. The solution was always about, we need to buy this new software.
Yeah. Yeah.
So then we got HighSpot to do something. And then we got, I can't remember. We had like Asana to do something. We had Trello to do something. We had, like, just within the marketing team, there were 10 different products, and yet they weren't doing the basics. And I'm like, what do we need all these products? So people view tech as a panacea. But what you actually need is your problem solved. Now, with both Frazee and Drumbeat, we've always been very, very focused on the problem statement. Frazee was, if you're not getting enough opens and clicks from your emails, then Frazee can solve that problem. And it did that very well.
Yeah.
Drumbeat is, if you spend all your time thinking, wishing, complaining, dreaming about marketing instead of actually doing it, then Drumbeat solves that problem on an end-to-end basis. Where a lot of people go wrong is they just get technical bloat and they sign up to all these softwares. And, you know, if anybody listening, think about all the softwares that you use within your business. There's what? There's 30, 40, 50 of them. If you took that down to 10, would your life be better or worse? I think the answer is usually better.
Yeah. I feel like you're a psychologist asking me, like, would your life be? Yeah, it would be better. It would be better. Yeah, absolutely. And that's something, yeah, I would agree. Something I've learned over the, I've been in marketing, what, 20 years. And the longer I've been in it, the more experience I am in it, the more I think that there are a few key big things you need to work out and problems you need to solve. And then everything else is just, as you say, is the stuff you need to do day to day and can be done in whatever way it can be done. It's not that important to spend too much time on those things.
Yeah.
True story. So, my last question was about this sort of uncomfortable truths about implementing AI. I guess you've given us some there, which is, yeah, AI is not always the answer and you need to think about that. Are there any other things that occur in terms of, yeah, if you're thinking about implementing AI, what could be some of the challenges you would have? What are the sort of questions you should be asking yourself before you do that?
Well, yeah. So like, when people talk about AI these days, they're generally talking about large language models. So yeah. I'll limit my answer to that. But it's worth just noting, for educational reasons, there's many, many different forms of AI. Some of which, like large language models themselves are basically this huge database. Like, the way that large language models work is basically these companies scraped the entire internet. And then they built this fantastic model that can predict what word is most likely to follow a second word. So it uses some call it a stochastic parrot. So a parrot it speaks back to you in something that sounds human, even though it's not human. And then stochastic. What stochastic means is it's random within a certain boundary of randomness. So a great example of a stochastic problem is, if you flip a coin, the outcome is either heads or tails. Whether it's heads or tails, it's completely random, but you know the answer is going to be heads or tails. That's a stochastic boundary of a random problem. So these large language models are like that. If you ask it to complete this sentence, my cat's breath smells like, then it'll give you an answer. It could be cat food, it could be canaries, it could, you know, all sorts of things, right? But it'll be within a bound of reasonableness most of the time. The stochastic system follows a normal curve. So most of the time, the answer is within something you would expect. But every once in a while, the answer is something that's totally bonkers. And that's where you get a lot of the crazy answers that you get from AI. And these systems are getting better and better, but the fundamental architectural nature of these systems is they are stochastic parrots. Hmm. So what you will find in any system that use AI is they'll be right or right-ish. They'll be defensibly correct most of the time until they're not. And this presents many, many problems. I would liken these systems to a consultant from McKinsey. I don't know if you ever had the misfortune of dealing with consultants from McKinsey, but they are always confident.
Yeah.
And sometimes they're also right.
A dangerous combination is fair to say. Good. Right. Okay. What we like to do is leave everybody with a practical takeaway, one thing they could go and do very quickly in short order this week or something in order to help their business. So have you got a little thing that people could just go and do right away? Obviously, go and look at This Is Drumbeat. We'll get onto that. But is there something else people could be doing right away to try and help their business using AI?
When you're trying to solve a problem, don't worry about the solution. Think about the problem. Think about it deeply. Take in all the information you can.
Yeah.
Then go for a walk in the forest and the answer will come to you.
Yeah, I like that actually. That's a nice practical. Yeah, go and do it right now. Think about your problem. Have a shower. That always helps. So where can people find you, Parry? They can find you on LinkedIn. You are Parry Malm on LinkedIn. You're probably the only one, right? Because there are not that many Parrys in the world. I think that's something we've learned.
There are not. You know, weirdly, I've met two other people in my life called Parry, and then the lead singer of an old pop punk band called Nerf Herder is also called Parry.
Oh, there you go.
Go figure.
But find you on Parry Malm. And then Drumbeat, this is drumbeat.com. Give us a pitch for Drumbeat. Do us the full pitch for this Drumbeat.
Yeah, I'll give you the short and sweet version. For the history of time, if you were doing marketing for a business, whether you're small, medium, or large, you had three options. Number one, you do it yourself and you stay up till 2 a.m. on Sunday, just doing all of this stuff. And then something else would come up and your efforts would fizzle out and it didn't get done. Option two is you hire a person. And I don't know if you've ever had to deal with people, but there are problems with it. They take sick days. They want to do the fun stuff. They want to, you know, film podcasts, but they don't want to do the boring stuff like send out newsletters and put posts on social over and over and over and over and over. Or you hire an agency where you spend a lot of money, you get pitched to by the agency founder or the partner. And then when it comes to actually implementing it, you get relegated to the new grad. And what usually happens, you get meh output for maximum price. Those were your only options until the advent of AI. And that's why I built Drumbeat. The option now is an end-to-end AI system that plans, creates, and orchestrates marketing everywhere it matters.
Nice. Excellent. So if people are interested in that, this is drumbeat.com. I have to say, I used to work with these two guys, one called Parry and one called Johnny. They were a bit of an interesting. So I don't know what happened to those guys. Who knows? Who knows?
Bunch of deadbeats.
Bunch of deadbeats. Bunch of drumbeats, perhaps.
Hey.
Thanks for joining us today, Parry. Thank you, everybody, for listening. We'll see you next time on Browse Basket Buy. Thank you, everybody. Browse Basket Buy is brought to you by your friends at Revlifter. Promotions work, but they damage brand and margins. Revlifter's intelligent offers drive results by using behavioral signals to target the right customers at the right time. Customers typically see 20% more conversions, 30% higher AOV, 5% more revenue, and a 10% saving on promotional costs. So stop wasting discounts on people who'd buy anyway. Try Revlifter free for 90 days, and they'll handle all the heavy lifting. Visit revlifter.com to find out more. That's revlifter.com.